time to catch up with the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life. Island Life is a weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues, and it's brought to you with the support of Placemakers every Saturday morning from 10 till 12. Last Saturday, Jan Scott was your host, and she caught up with Vern Whitehead from the Waiheke Rugby Club, Brian Griffiths, who talked about community gardens, Michael Downey, the writer and performer of The Orderly, a show which was on Artworks Theatre, and of course, Steve the Butcher, who talked about slow cooking.
And it's my pleasure to welcome to the show Vern Whitehead, who's the president of the Waiheke Rugby Club at the moment. Welcome, Vern.
Glad to be here, Jan.
Right. Now, I understand that the rugby club's gone through something of a metamorphosis over the last five years or so. It was in the doldrums there for a while, but now it's really cracking along.
We've always been a strong club in junior grades, the under sixes through to the under 13s. But in the last few years, we've concentrated on building the senior team, encouraging rugby at the high school. And this year, we have a middleweight team as well, the second senior team. So we've got a natural flow on. The juniors go to high school, play for the high school team, come out the other end and have got a middleweights team, which is an under 85 kgs. To play for, so they're not getting too knocked around in senior football when they're still not ready.
Right, so they would be what, 17 to 19 year olds? Or?
Yeah, 17 is right. They're almost through to 70 year olds the other end. There's no restriction on age, and it's a really popular grade in Auckland rugby. There are 30 teams entered in the middleweights competition this year. And Waiheke is in the first pool, and the season kicks off this coming Saturday, and we're at Onitangi Sports Park.
That's Saturday week, the 18th?
Yes.
Right. And is there also a senior team playing that day?
Yes. The middleweights play at 1 o'clock, and they've got a game against the Waitakere Falcons. And then at 2:45, the seniors play Grammar Carlton.
That should be a good game. And it's very important for the boys to have some cheering on the sideline and people there to support them.
Yeah, it is. This is a real red letter day for us, having the two senior teams play. And the middleweights particularly will need plenty of support because several of the players are not experienced rugby players, but they did really well, and they've had one pre-season game, which they drew 17-all with College Rifles. That is one of the top teams in the competition, so we're hoping for big things for the middleweights.
That sounds great. And I think also you're starting a new service for the supporters and having things like gourmet burgers that they can buy.
Yeah, it's, we always have the club rooms open after home games. We're not the focus is on the rugby, not on the entertainment, but we always have a great night after home games. And we're planning this season to feed the punters as well as the players.
Well, I've been involved with the club for a couple of years now, and I've been going along there to support the players, and I've always found the atmosphere afterwards is great. It's a family atmosphere, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. We've got to remember that we're very strong in the junior grades and the under-sixes and right through to the under-13s, and it's great watching the kids on a Saturday morning, girls and boys, playing and enjoying the rugby. And that flows through to the club, that while everybody enjoys a beer after the game, the emphasis is on the hospitality and the entertainment and the rugby, not so much on the drink.
Absolutely. And you also have nights down at the club rooms to watch things like the Super 14, don't you?
Yeah.
The Blues are playing and sticking.
Yeah, we've got a big screen at the club rooms. And depending on who's playing. Often the you have the games during the afternoon, and then it flows through into the evening, and there's often a Super 14 game on at 7:30, and some supporters come down just for that, and you get a continuity of entertainment. Mm.
You mentioned just a moment ago about the girls' team. Now, how old are the, what sort of age group would that be? Is there only the one team? Or?
No, the girls play mixed rugby. Boys and girls are in the junior teams. And this year they're playing Ripper Rugby in the younger grades, which is quite exciting, and it adds a new dimension to it. And Cindy Page is our junior grade coordinator, and she does a great job in getting managers and coaches for all the teams. And
so how old are they, those juniors? What age range?
They start from 4 years old, playing in the under sixes, and there's no tackling and no scrums and that sort of thing in the junior grades, and they move up progressively, and they start tackling, and then they start having scrums and lineouts. But that comes with the main objective in the under sixes is for the kids just to have fun.
Yeah, that sounds great. If somebody wanted to get involved, wanted to take their kids along for that, how would they do that? Do they have to go down to the club rooms, or they ring somebody?
Yeah, Cindy Page is the best person to contact. And their competition starts after the school holidays. So they're a couple of weeks later than the seniors, which kick off on Saturday, next Saturday.
Right. Mm. Getting back to the seniors, as I mentioned before, our senior team, well, the rugby club itself was sort of in the doldrums a few years ago because they were underfunded and that sort of thing. And then a group of people, yourself included, got in behind it and really got that going with good sponsorship from Main Freight and SeaLink, and that's continued, hasn't it?
Yeah, we owe a lot to Main Freight and to SeaLink. They're our major sponsors, and they do a marvellous job in funding the club. We're at a disadvantage living on an island but competing in an Auckland competition, and it costs us something between $20,000 and $30,000 a year in travel alone that the players have to that we have to find. And the two major sponsors, SeaLink, who provide travel, and Main Freight, who provide funding, are really important in doing that. And Auckland Rugby is also very supportive of rugby on Waiheke. We've got a particularly good facility at Onitangi Sports Park, and later this year we hope to host the Auckland team, the Auckland and New Zealand Cup team. Earlier this season we had the Blues here, and we hope that it will lead through to 2011, the Rugby World Cup, when the ground will be used as a training ground by teams participating in the Cup. And with a little luck, we'll also see a team hosted on the island.
That would be brilliant for Waiheke, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And I think there's some positive vibes out there about that, isn't there?
Yeah, there are. The ground at Onitangi was used as a test bed for Eden Park's redevelopment. And when they laid the new ground at Eden Park, they just happened that Waiheke Onitangi Sports Park was being built at the same time. And Auckland City used it, as I said, for a test bed. And the ground is just never cuts up. It's all weather. Even in the depths of winter, it's still great to play on. Doesn't get muddy. And this is a real factor in why we firmly believe that we'll be successful in hosting teams for training, and ultimately in hosting a team on the island during the World Cup.
Yeah, because by that stage we should have some world-class accommodation or more than we already have.
Yes, and we're looking forward very much to the new hotel being built on the island, and seeing Brent Gibson's dream come true. and that will be just fantastic. The what it means to the island is it will give tremendous publicity, and we're acutely aware as a rugby club that we do depend on community support, and this is our chance to put something back and getting mileage in Europe, particularly showing the beautiful island and the beaches and the wine and the olive groves would be just fantastic against the spawning backdrop that the Rugby World Cup is. It's the third biggest sporting event in the world, and the coverage, TV coverage, goes to 4 billion people in a couple of hundred countries. So we'd like to be part of that and see why he keeps his name up in lights.
And the club has already made approaches or been proactive in contacting teams during the last World Cup, haven't they? It's just say we'd be willing to host and
there's a
dangling the carrot there.
Yeah, the groundwork's been done, and we have to go through a process, which is Rugby World Cup Limited, which Martin Sneddon heads up. But they're very much aware of what Waiheke has to offer. The idea of having superb facilities on an island 35 minutes by ferry from the mainland, and where the players are could be kept entertained, stimulated by the lovely facilities and all the attractions of an island, and yet you're only 35 minutes away from downtown, only a few minutes longer to the airport to catch your flight to wherever the games were. Yeah. So we think Waiheke is ideally suited.
Mm. That's very exciting. Now, of course, the rugby club isn't just for the kids or the players. It's desperately needs help from mums, dads, anybody out there who can give some time to all the other things that happen behind the scenes, the training and the managing and the hospitality and ferrying people to and from the walls,
yeah,
and things like that.
The logistics of running a club are really interesting, and we're just blessed on Waiheke with people that get behind it. Some of them don't know anything about rugby, but they see the kids enjoying the sport, wanting to become All Blacks, they just get in behind the thing. Coaches, managers, travel managers, that sort of thing. I'd like to also put in a little plug for under 85 kg players. It looks really good in numbers wise. But Dan Robson is the coach, and building a new team is something that requires real effort. And Dan's also looking for additional players, players that maybe have given up the game, and that whether they're 30 or 40, as long as they're under 85 kgs, then Dan can be reached on 021-460-425.
That's Dan Robson for the under 85 team. If you're interested in getting involved with that, give him a ring. You'll have a lot of fun. Do we have a contact for Cindy Page, or is she in the phone book?
Yeah, she's in the phone book.
She's in the phone book. Yeah. Okay, because Cindy is the lady to contact if your kids want to get involved, or if you want to get involved helping out with the kids' teams. That'd be great. And, of course, Vern, you're available, aren't you, if anybody wants to help out with anything else. You can give Vern a ring on 372-9109. Thank you, Vern, for coming in. We look forward to it. And get down to the Waiheke Sports Park next Saturday at what time?
1 o'clock for the under-85s, 2:45 for the seniors.
It'll be a great afternoon for the family. And it doesn't cost anything. Thanks, Vin.
This is Denise Roach. You're listening to Waiheke Radio.
And it's my pleasure now to introduce Brian Griffiths, who is involved with the Onitangi Community Garden. Brian, tell us something about that.
Well, the idea of community gardens, of course, is to get people working together to produce more food locally. And there are all sorts of reasons why, at the moment, this is happening. I mean, those of us involved are doing it, of course, because we have our own gardens and we enjoy gardening. But wherever you go and whoever you listen to these days, you come to the conclusion that we have to be more resourceful locally, more resilient locally. We have to accept a greater responsibility as communities to actually look after ourselves. And growing our own food is obviously a very, very important part of this. Increasingly people want to know exactly what they are eating and where it comes from. And of course, if you're very, very, very close to growing things locally, this information is immediately available to you. So, if you like, that's the imperative behind what we are doing with community gardens on Waiheke.
When did the Oni Tangi one start up?
Well, the Oni Tangi one really is a brand new garden. We've got on Waiheke, we have at the moment 4 community gardens. One of those has been going for 3 or 4 years. That's the one at Ostend, and if you haven't actually seen that garden, it's well worth a visit. The other 3 gardens, one at Onatangi, one at Surfdale, one at Blackpool, are really in their first year of operation, so it's all very, very new. And for instance, the Onatangi garden, we've only actually had, if you like, one crop during this past spring and summer season. So it's very early days. We're still learning what the land is, what the ground is capable of producing. We've made mistakes, and hopefully, when we grow things during this coming winter, we will actually do things a little bit better. So it's all very, very new. We're discovering a whole lot of things as we go along and learning.
Has somebody donated the land that you're planting on?
Yes, what happens, of course, with the four gardens that we have, people actually lend us, if you like, the land to use for a short period of time. It's all very, very informal and very friendly, very, very casual. As time goes on, it may need to become more structured, but at the moment, yes, people offer us the land, and away we go from there. There's a lot of land on Waiheke Island that is not being used at all, or certainly being underused. So there's any amount of potential for doing more and more in the way of community gardening on the island.
Now, what did you have to do to get started?
Well, I think it really it was the way this all started was from the Seed Savers Group, Waiheke Seed Savers Group, which I've been part of for almost 10 years now. And it's a group of people who meet every month, the last Sunday and every month, and started off sharing seeds, doing it in quite a structured and formal way, but more recently it's become an opportunity for us to visit other gardens, to exchange seed, and to simply help each other and encourage each other in growing things. And out of that has developed the community garden initiative. And then out of the Community Garden Initiative, of course, the food exchange table at the Saturday market. So these three things are very, very closely related.
Has there been a cost involved, or is it simply hard work?
Well, it's interesting because we're doing this on literally a shoestring. The cost is minimal. We're doing the work. A lot of the things that, the materials that we're using are donated materials. But when we need money, money is coming in through the grow table at the market. Although this is a food exchange, many people come along and take things from the table and give us a donation. And the return from that table over a period of 3 years, I think we've been going now, has been sufficient to actually support the 4 community gardens. And we can see a lot of potential to expand on this.
Is there, I think some people are thinking that with a community garden there'd be cost involved in a retaining wall or building up the beds and that sort of thing, the sleepers that you'd put around the beds, and that could be quite an expensive process. Have you found that, or have you done it in a more simple fashion?
Well, there are lots of different ways of doing it. It really depends on what the garden is, where the garden is. Now, we have some raised beds. There are raised beds at Ostend. There are raised beds at Blackpool. Well, the Blackpool example is interesting because the community garden there is on council land. It's a reserve. And council has actually supported us very, very well and provided some money and materials for the building of those raised beds. But you don't necessarily have to have raised beds. There are other ways that you can do it. Oh, I might also mention that the transfer station, our wonderful transfer station, has been just so fantastic in the support they have given us. They've provided free compost for all the gardens, and not just once, but on a number of occasions, which has been fantastic. So no, the cost is not great.
That's great. These gardens, are they connected insofar as there's a group who oversee it all, and you have a liaison with each other and you work in together, or is it each one is individual?
Ah, okay. Well, as time goes on, of course, we are finding the need to be a bit more structured and a bit more formal, but the gardens do operate independently in a sense, but every month, the first Monday evening of each month, we do get together, all the representatives from all the gardens, and discuss how things are going and how we can support one another. We have 10 or 12 people meeting in that way. So the only thing that at the moment that we are requiring of the people involved in each of the gardens is that what they are doing is not to be used for their own individual pecuniary advantage. So it's something we are doing for the community. For example, the Onatangi Garden is getting into providing quite a significant amount of food for the budgetary service, and we see that as a very, very worthy and important thing for us to be doing. So the surplus would be used, I think, in that way for the Onatangi group. Now the others are producing or using their surplus in slightly different ways, but it is being shared around in the community.
That is brilliant.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereabouts in Onatangi is the garden?
Now the garden is up in Seaview Road. It's number 399, it's quite accessible from Onatangi Beach. You just got 7th Avenue, and it's just along from the Backpackers Hostel.
Right, so it's easy to find.
It's
is
very
it
easy
signposted
to find.
Or
it's right by a bus stop.
Oh, that's handy.
Okay, right by bus stop. So yes, it is handy, but very easy to find. Just it's about 50 to 100 meters along from the hostel.
And what sort of plants have you put in?
Well, we're looking. Our first crop was a potato crop. That's what we thought of growing first up. It wasn't a fantastic success. Potatoes have this season particularly been quite tricky to grow for various reasons. So we weren't quite as successful with the potatoes as we had hoped. But other things have done well. Cucumbers, courgettes, tomatoes, kumikumi, and some brassicas as well. So we certainly are going to be able to grow things. The winter crop is going to be, I think, mainly brassicas. I think we'll concentrate on those.
Do you liaise with the other gardens as to what they're putting in, so you don't end up with everybody planting brassicas?
Well, yes, we do. We at our monthly meetings, we're able to exchange information about what we should grow. But at the moment, with only four gardens, it's very unlikely, and they're not big gardens. It's very unlikely that we would be overproducing any crop.
Mm. Do you have any trees, fruit trees?
There are fruit trees. The Ostend Garden has fruit trees, a very good orchard there because it was an established garden when we took it on. The Surfdale Garden, they're going to put in fruit trees there and are talking about possibly establishing a very small food forest, which becomes a self-contained operation. So that is planned there. The other two gardens, I'm saying I'm not quite sure. We may actually in future put some fruit trees in, but we're not absolutely certain about that at this stage.
What sort of area have you got there?
We're only looking. All of these gardens are on just small, if you like, barely quarter acre sections. So they are quite small gardens.
Right. Now, your garden dig tomorrow on Easter Sunday is from 11 to 1. What is the objective of that? Are you digging up the new garden?
Yeah, we want to actually make a start planting our winter garden. And Jennifer and I have got a whole lot of seedlings that we'll be bringing along. So planting is part of the exercise, a very important part of it, but more particularly we'd like to make contact with other people who might be interested in, over time, to get, you know, becoming involved in this initiative on the island, on Tangi or wherever.
Hmm. Well, of course, this is the thing, that it's a great initiative, but you've got to have willing hands to keep it going, to come along every week and weed and do all those sorts of chores, don't you?
Yes, but it's very interesting that if you've got three or four or five people who are prepared to put in a little bit of time and energy, just how much you can achieve in a very short time. And of course, once your garden is established, it becomes that much easier. The hard part is breaking it in initially. Summer, of course, watering is important, but you know, you can water a small garden, it can be watered in a relatively short time. Got a water supply handy, and caring for crops at other times. Well, in an hour, three or four people can do a lot of work in a garden of that size.
Do you have your own compost heap?
We haven't got a proper compost system organised on Tangi yet, but at Ostend, a very quite sophisticated composting system using Bokashi as well, and we will eventually be using Bokashi at Onatengi.
Pardon my ignorance, but what's Bokashi?
Well, Bokashi, it's a Japanese system of, just in very simple terms, making use of fruit scraps from the kitchen in a way that is certainly much more pleasant than the traditional composting. You use the juice that's created, and you use the solids as well that result from the process. You can find out about Bokashi by going to Cleanstream Transfer Station shop.
So it's something that the home gardener could
do. It's something that I would recommend for everybody to use. Mm. Either that, the Bokashi system, or a worm farm, as well as ordinary conventional composting. All three systems are very, you know, highly commended. Mm. And will actually complement one another.
Right. Now, the system that you use for the garden, is it, I remember reading something about the lasagna garden, you know, that where you have layers of old carpet and newspapers and things like that before you put your mulch and things on the top. Do you do that sort of thing, or is it just digging up the garden, digging up the ground and putting some...
Interestingly, the jury's out, I guess, on any one particular methodology, gardening methodology, being superior to others. And it depends on the situation. But there are quite a lot of people that swear by no-dig gardening. So you just, the stuff goes straight in. Covering the ground with carpet, or, which is, these days is perhaps a bit questionable because carpets are often loaded with synthetic stuff. And don't break down cardboard and newspaper and garden mulch, grass and clippings and that sort of thing. Very, very useful for building up the productivity of a garden. The layering process really involves making sure that you've got that water is going to be able to do its job properly. the garden will retain moisture, will drain properly, will contain the sorts of nutrients that are required. So a lasagna method is a very good method, definitely, and certainly to be recommended. But it's only one of a number of different methods.
Well, it could be useful for some areas, such as where I live in Rocky Bay, that's very clay, got a lot of clay soil, and that's not necessarily good for a garden.
Well, that's right. The gap, I'm not sure what the, is it gap 7 or gap 12 or something. It's the finest grade of quarry material that you get from our local quarry. That is actually used in the raised beds and used very, very, very effectively with layers of, with a layer of just ordinary soil, which will have a lot of clay in it. And then in mulch on top. So you've got that's a lasagna bed, if you like, in very simple terms. Right. And that's combined with the raised sides.
Right. Well, you're listening to Waiheke Radio, and I'm Jan Scott, and we're talking to Brian Griffiths about the Onitangi Community Garden. Well, community gardens and gardens in general we've got around to, really. Brian, specifically getting back to the Onitangi Community Gardens, you've got this, I suppose you'd call it a working bee tomorrow, and encouraging people to come along with their spades and garden gloves and get in there and help plant the new crop. Is that right?
Yes. So we want to encourage people that probably or possibly haven't been involved previously. We're emphasising this is for all members of the family, so there'll be something for children as well. There will be a bit of a treasure hunt and some Easter eggs, and there'll be an opportunity for the children to do little tasks that will hopefully stimulate them and encourage them to be doing things at home and, of course, in school. The schools are doing a brilliant job in promoting the growing of things locally, which is fantastic.
Mm. And I guess whilst this is a great community event for people living or holidaying in Onitangi, if you feel inclined to come over the hill from Rocky Bay or somewhere else and help out, that wouldn't be your problem.
Oh, absolutely, yes, anybody's welcome.
Yes, yeah. And you'd learn something, no doubt.
Well, yes.
Absolutely. Now, I presume that you're all clean and green and you don't use pesticides or insecticides or anything like that.
The intention is to grow things organically. I mean, this is what we really want to do. That's certainly the way we're going. It may take a bit of time for us to get to the stage where we could be accredited if we wanted to be accredited organically, but yes, we're organic. Yeah.
Great. Now, the section that you're using at 399 CV Road, which is right by the bus stop for those of you who don't have a car here or want to use public transport, what state was that in when you started? Was it covered in grass or gorse?
It was a mass of kikuyu, very heavy kikuyu growth. It hadn't been worked for some time, although part of it had been a garden previously, so it did require a lot of hard work to start off with. We got it cut down to start with, raked back all the long grass, and then laid down layers of cardboard and put the grass on top. And that way we succeeded in not completely killing the kikuyu roots, but rendering the ground workable with a spade and a fork. We didn't particularly want to do a rotary hoeing exercise because the topsoil is quite shallow and then there's all this clay underneath, so we didn't want to go turning that over too much. So that's the way we did it.
Right.
It was reasonably successful.
Yeah. Yeah, clay seems to be a real problem on the island.
Oh,
it
is.
Yes.
Yes.
And kikuyu grass is a great
yes.
problem in lots
yes.
of places.
Yes.
Although it's quite good at keeping the sand together on the foreshore.
Yes.
It has its purposes, I suppose, but it's not
yes.
so good when you're trying
yes.
to establish
yes.
a garden.
Well, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you've got this working bee this Sunday to establish the garden to put in the crops for the winter. And no doubt you'll have another one. What about Labour Weekend to start your summer planting?
That would, well, possibly a bit earlier than that. We'd be starting, I mean, because of the very mild climate on Waiheke, we garden all the year round, and the spring summer crop, you're really starting back in September, October. We'll be looking at potatoes again, certainly, and we'll be putting broad beans in at some stage, I would imagine. Then as I say, spring, September, October, you're quite early on, you'll be into getting the warmer season crops in.
Have you got a plentiful supply of seeds and seedlings?
Well,
or do you need more?
That's, generally speaking, that is not too much of a problem because almost all of us involved are growing things ourselves. We're keeping seed, we're growing our own seedlings, we just simply use a bit of extra. So there's always a surplus.
Oh, that's good. So you don't have a shortfall.
Nope.
That's great. Okay, well, if you're wanting to do something a bit different tomorrow, take the family along to 399 CV Road, Onitangi, at 11 o'clock for the garden dig and for the Onitangi Community Garden Organisation. And if you've got any queries on that, then give Brian a ring on 372 7662. Thank you, Brian, for coming along.
Thank you very much, Jane.
You're listening to Island Life, brought to you by Placemakers. Know how, can do.
I'm Jan Scott, and it's my pleasure to introduce now Michael Darney, who is the writer and the actor of The Orderly, which is playing at Artworks tonight and tomorrow. Welcome, Michael.
Good morning.
Now, this is an interesting concept, isn't it? Would you like to tell us a little bit about it, how it happened and came about?
It started as a project when I was doing a master's degree at the Auckland University. And then we developed that further. Me and Anders Falstead Jensen, who directs the play, we formed a company immediately after leaving university. And a reworking of that play that we developed there, or I developed there, became The Orderly eventually, and we formed the company The Rebel Alliance, and this was our first production, which we did at the Herald Theatre in Auckland about nearly 3 years ago, just over 3 years ago now. So, and we've toured it around since. We've done two or three more seasons in Auckland. We've taken it to Wellington, Upper Hutt, and at the Auckland Museum as well. So it's had a bit of a life now.
Right, so how did you come to write this play?
Originally it was an exercise in at the university. I could do a paper where I could do my own project, basically, and I just decided I wanted to do a solo play. There was just something about that I wanted to do that. And it was too late to write something, so I got this ancient poem called The Battle of Morden, which is an ancient Saxon poem, and I wanted to develop that as a solo piece, a 40-minute short solo piece. And that was fine, but also in another class I had developed a monologue about a hospital orderly based on a person I knew when I was an orderly at North Shore Hospital a few years ago. And I actually ended up putting those two together, those two ideas, for this project, whereby the hospital orderly narrated or guided you through the action of the poem, because it was quite old and archaic, so we needed someone almost from the present day to guide us through that adaptation. And it turned, because he was a reenactor, the person I based it on, Peter Russell, was a reenactor. He was a Viking reenactor. So we made him into a Saxon reenactor, because they're the good guys fighting the Vikings. And it just all came together, and we still called it The Battle of Morden. It was about the poem, but when we took it, opened it professionally, in 2006, we changed the name to The Orderly. We made it more about him, but still had the poem in it. And we brought in other characters from the hospital, which I all played myself, and it just developed. And every time we've done the play, we've done rewrites, we've put little bits in here and there, taken bits out, and it's just it's developed its own life now, where it's this combination of a hospital. You see a hospital room, what goes on in there, with this little man making a bed, and then he goes into the world of this ancient poem, because his reenactment group is fighting this battle on the weekend, and the poem was written about this battle, this famous battle. So he goes into that world, and basically it parallels, there's a parallel between what happens in the hospital and what happens on the battlefield. And that's basically what happens on stage.
Right. So this is a one-man show.
Mm-hmm.
The New Zealand Herald, in their critique, said, Darney displays consummate skill in the demanding art of the one-man show and seems to effortlessly carry off the lightning-quick character changes that allow him to hold up both sides of a conversation. How many characters do you play?
I think it's all up. I have to think about that. Between 9 and 15.
Right.
Probably about 8 or 9. There's about 4 or 5 characters in the hospital, and in the battlefield I play a narrator of the poem and also 2 or 3 warriors that are fighting within that battle. So, yeah, it's about 9 or 10 or 11, something like that, all up.
Whoa, that's a lot to remember. A lot of costume changes? Or
no, not at all. I just become the characters. I just sort of step to one side and step back again, and he just wears his little white uniform. He's got a hospital bed. There's a couple of banners to the side which represent the world of the poem, and he just starts talking to the audience, and the first character that comes on is just suddenly there, and that's how it's done. We didn't want to fool around with any kind of changes or wigs or any of that stuff, because I've seen that done before, and it's quite frankly quite bad. When that's done, I think personally it just doesn't look real to me.
Right, so you have a fairly simplistic outfit on that.
Yeah.
It's
body shape. I just turn into another body shape, and all I really did when I worked at the hospital was do impressions of people that worked there, so it's basically doing that all the time now.
Was The Orderly the first play you'd written?
More or less. I'd always written stuff before, but when I did this course at the university, we were encouraged, I did a writing paper, and I'd never really written plays before. I'd written some short stories and poems, that kind of thing. And so I started writing a play a week with little short scenes that we had to write every week as an exercise, and it just opened up my mind to the possibilities. And as I said, the little monologue came out, other things came out, and at the end of that year I actually entered a one-page play thing that was put on in Hamilton and Wellington, and that got included. So I thought, oh, this is good. So that was kind of the first thing I really wrote officially. But this was the first big, almost full-length play. And
And The Orderly was the winner of, or one of the winners of Playwright 07. Right?
Oh, no, that was Aroha. That was a different play I did 2 years ago. Smack Bang Theatre Company run a little competition called Playwright for one-act plays, and that was totally independent of The Orderly. And the play I wrote for that did become one of the winners. So that was cool. That was nice. That's good to have other things going on other than just the one that you're in. And so that was interesting because I was in a room where there were other actors performing my lines, and I came in quite late to look at a rehearsal, and it was a strange feeling not being on stage and seeing your lines perform. That's a totally different kind of feeling and process to The Orderly, where I've kind of developed it in rehearsal a lot. A lot of the work we've done with my director has been developed in a rehearsal, improvised, workshopped, and that was just a play I wrote that other people did. And when I saw it, I was... But it was good in the end. It was really fun. That was a fun little play.
Mm. I'm talking to Michael Darney, who's an actor and has written the play The Orderly, which is playing at Artworks tonight at 8 p.m. and tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. Michael, is this a play that would appeal to a wide variety of people? Is it a family play? Is it?
Yes, it does. It, because it's about a man who works in a low-paid job and the struggles he has with that job and how he wants to escape that job, and he kind of does through his reenacting. We got to know a lot of the reenactors around Auckland when we first put on the play, as sort of research and promotion for reasons for that. And so people can relate to being trapped in a job they hate, wanting to escape into a different world. It's a moving play in the sense that it becomes a moving situation without giving it too much away of the plot. But there's also a lot of comic moments. The characters are very funny. The juxtaposition between him trying to be an ancient warrior and be a hero and then having to do a horrible job in a hospital, there's a lot of that clash, which brings out a lot of comedy. So, it does appeal. We've had people, all sorts of people, come to it and enjoy it because it does have a bit of everything, a bit of laughter, you know.
So with the reenactment parts of it, did you have to go and do training for sword fighting and that sort of thing?
For one bit, I kind of did. There's one scene where I do a sword fight, but I do it between myself and myself, you know, to see how that's done. And actually, I had to practice a few basic moves for that. It's almost choreographed rather than training. But thankfully, my director was really good with that. He basically came up with the moves because he's a martial arts expert. So he's got a black belt in karate. So he kind of knew how to get me into that sort of zone.
And well, he basically, yeah. You didn't go along to one of these medieval, groups that recreate medieval battles and things?
No, we didn't. But, yes, we did. When we first, back in 2005, before we did the play, we went to the Highland Games, where the Romans and the Vikings had a battle, and we got to know a lot of those guys, because they knew Peter, they knew this man, he's dead now, so they knew him when he was alive. And when we did it at the first performance we did, the first season, as a promotional thing, we actually organised a battle between the Vikings and the Norse in Aotea Square. And that really helped the promotion. So that was an idea of my director and producer. He came up with this idea, and it just was fantastic. So yeah, we did have quite a few dealings with those people,
right?
And we saw a bit of what they did. Yeah.
And talking of your producer and director, how did you meet Anders?
At the University of Auckland, doing as I said, the masters in drama studies. He's from Denmark. He'd come over here after studying in Denmark and decided he wanted to do a post-grad degree, and I'd already done drama school years before that and done some other things and done other acting and had worked for a while obviously at the hospital, and then I just decided about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that I wanted to go back and study drama at a formal level again. I was kind of missing it. I hadn't really done it for a little while at that point. And we met doing that and found some common ground and interests in what we wanted to do, and kind of towards the end of that year, 2 years, we kind of were thinking about that we wanted to form a company, and then The Orderly became the best vehicle to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So are you working exclusively for that company now, or is he still involved with other things?
We do different things. We basically freelance. Like I still do acting for other companies when it comes up, and little bits here and there, and like, you know, I wrote that play for the other competition, and Nan is he produces different. He produced one of the plays at the Auckland Festival recently, stage managed something else recently. He works for the film festival every year as a publicist, jack of all trades really. So we do have to keep our hands in and do. And I also work a lot at the Auckland Museum doing drama programs, helping out with drama programs for families and schools and stuff like that. So, yeah, you have to pay the bills. You have to really do a few different things.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I noticed that Anders has worked as a producer for the Indian Ink Theatre
Company. That's right,
The makers of Krishna's Dairy, The Candlestick Maker, The Pickle King and The Dentist's Chair, which were really popular.
And, yeah, that was really good.
And lots of accolades.
That helped him a lot with developing skills as a producer, and also we learned a lot through that with Jacob and Justin with Indian Ink, because it was a similar setup in that we started one actor and writer and one producer director as they did with Krishna's Dairy. So we got a lot of inspiration and ideas from them. That helped a lot in the early days.
Now, are you actually touring The Orderly at the moment, or is this just a one-off?
This is a one-off. We've never really been on an extended tour. We've done little territories here and there. We've done Wellington, we've done Upper Hutt, and stuff like that. So it's just, and last year we did a charity season for the Mercy Hospice. It was Pay What You Like to help out with the charity for the hospices. And so yeah, it's never been a long-term tour thing, but we sort of take it out of the box every now and then when it comes up, and it seems to have a long ongoing life where people keep popping out, like with Waiheke. Hey, can you do this play? Yeah. So.
So, excuse me. You were approached to come here.
I believe so. It was mainly Anders got the approach, I believe. And we thought, oh, yeah. And we came out here a few months ago and had a look at the venue and decided, yep, that'll work. And it's kind of crept up on us, you know, because we haven't done it since August last year, so I've had to go back to the script and go through it all again. But that's good. It's good that every now and then we get that And we've just had it, it's going to be broadcast on radio in May as well.
So that's coming up in May. That's the question I was going to ask. I noticed they set a version set to air early in 2009.
Yep.
What channel do we know?
That's Radio New Zealand National.
Okay.
And we recorded that middle of last year, and it's actually going to be broadcast on the 24th of May.
On the 24th of May.
3:06 p.m. 6 minutes past three.
3:06 p.m. And what day of the week is that?
It's a Sunday.
It's a Sunday. Well, that's Sunday okay. Drama Sunday spot. Afternoon drama spot. On national program. We don't mind plugging your position
every
now and then.
Yeah.
And what date again?
It's the 24th of May.
The 24th of May.
It's provisional confirmation of that, yeah.
Right. Are you working on anything else at the moment?
I've been working a lot at the museum just recently. We've got a busy program with school holidays and so forth coming up, and this is sort of right in the middle of it. And trying to write some new stuff, finding that a little bit difficult because it's just what I want to do. Exactly, it's hard to decide, but...
So have you got any ideas of what the theme might be?
Kind of. I've narrowed it down to about three or four ideas, and I'm trying to desperately work out what I want to do with it and actually do it. It's always difficult often to focus on one thing and get it done.
So we might see you back here with your new play at some stage.
You never know. The thing is, it could be for something that doesn't suit our company. It could be a totally different project that just could be for someone else or whatever, you know. Not everything you write can suit one particular genre or set of circumstances. But it might be. And there are vague kind of plans for a production for our company that we want to do. That we're thinking about at the moment. We're thinking about a couple of different ideas that we might want to do in the next year. And I might be a part of that, I might not. You know, it's just what happens.
That's great. Well, we're really pleased that you're able to do your play on Waiheke Island, and I hope a lot of people come along and support you tonight. 8 o'clock at Artworks, and tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m.
And it's 15 minutes long. It's a lovely little piece. I think, as I said, people will be able to relate to this character and what happens to him. A lot of empathy there.
Great. I've been talking to Michael Downey, actor and writer of The Orderly, which, as we just said, is on tonight at Artworks at 8 p.m. and tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. It sounds like a great show to go to, and I encourage you to go along and support Michael and his team. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Jan.
Nice to meet you.
Kia ora. This is Sophie Jo, and you're listening to Waiheke Radio.
And joining me now is our friendly village butcher, Steve Hill. Welcome, Steve.
Good morning.
Well, with the colder weather, we're probably looking at things like pot roasts and casseroles and slow roasts and all that sort of stuff.
Yes, it's getting that way. Slow, cheaper cuts of meat. If you do it cleverly, you probably get two or three meals out of one cook.
And what cut of meat would you suggest?
Anything, really. I'll have it on the bone. Lamb shoulders are really good. Whole chickens, shin beef, even shoulder pork.
When we're talking about cheaper cuts, of course, we're not talking about lesser quality. We're talking about more economical cuts, perhaps.
Yeah, basically, when we say cheaper cuts, like you say, we don't mean a cheaper quality. We just mean that it's not the expensive, quick cooking stuff like your beef fillets and sirloins, that sort of thing. Generally speaking, the cheaper cuts are from the parts of the animal that does most of the work. So they have a lot of muscle, strong connective tissue, which gives you a lot of flavour in your stock.
And that's why you've got to cook it slowly, otherwise it would be tough, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you've got to really, really plan ahead. Once you're cooking, you can basically sort of walk away and leave it for 3 or 4 hours. But it's in the preparation that makes the difference. if you've got a big enough pot, it's quite good to do two or three pieces of meat in the same pot. So then you can have, you've got two pieces of meat that you can use more or less straight away. You'll have a good stock which you can make soups with. Anything that's left on the bones, you could pick that off to put into your soup, or you could use that to make things like your cottage pies, shepherd's pies, that sort of thing.
You mentioned one of the important parts of doing a slow roast is the preparation. What did you mean by that?
Well, just get everything organised. Your vegetables prepped, brown the meat off, get that into your pot. It'd probably take maybe 20 minutes, half an hour.
It is important to brown the meat before you put it in.
Generally speaking, yeah. That gives you a nice seal on the outside of the meat. It helps keep the flavour and the juices in, and it gives you that nice caramelised shell, basically.
Yeah, I sometimes skip that part, and it certainly isn't the same end product, that's for sure. Yeah, if you're running out of time, you think, oh, I don't need to brown it, I'll just stick it in the pot and put everything else. And it doesn't quite work out the same.
It doesn't, no. You end up losing. I mean, you end up with a really good stock, but your meat's not that good.
No, that's right. We're talking about, somebody was talking to me about corned beef. And I thought to myself, now, what is corned beef? What is the actual piece of meat? Is it a topside steak, or topside roast, or what is that?
Well, generally, the packets that you get that's already done is generally silver side of beef.
Whereabouts is the silver side on a cow?
It's just under the rump. It's off the hind leg.
And is that a is it a cut you can use without it being corned?
Yeah, you can roast it. It does make a good roast beef. Obviously, it's a bit light on fat, so it's not as moist and tasty as, say, a topside or something like that that's got some fat with it. But it's ideal for things like pot roast. It's got a little bit of moisture in the cooking vessel, so that keeps it quite moist. You can barbecue it to a certain degree, but it's got to be a very, very slow, long sort of barbecue under a lid.
Right.
It's called broiling.
I don't think I've ever seen a cut silver side in a butcher shop or in the supermarket butchery department that hasn't been corned. I don't think I've seen a silver side cut. It's not particularly common, is it?
It used to be. It's one that is sort of largely forgotten these days. It's a two-part piece of meat. There's the round part, which gets used some places for things like beef schnitzel. You can use that for steaks, even sort of a barbecue steak. You slice it up and bash it with a meat bat. That tenderises it up, and it does come out well. It's obviously not as good as something like, say, sirloin or rump, but if you marinate in it, it's it does work out quite well for a cheaper barbecue type steak.
I guess if somebody wanted a silver side to pot roast, they, without it being corned, they'd need to order it from you, perhaps, rather than just walk in and expect to find one.
Yes. Once upon a time, we did try to make our own corned beef with the silver sides, but because it wasn't injected with chemicals and things, it wasn't the bright pink that people normally associate with corned beef. There was one or two people who actually sort of appreciated it, but the majority of people were expecting something that was, you know, sort of day-glow pink.
Yeah, that's something that worries me, actually, about corned beef when you see it or anything like that. It's that's been processed, I suppose, is what on earth has gone into it.
And it's basically nitrates that goes into it. That's what makes it
pink. Yeah. You could make a firecracker out of that.
Well, that's why you can't buy saltpeter readily these days. It is quite a important ingredient in gunpowder.
Yes. Isn't that incredible, the things we put into our body? I mean, we don't even think about it, I suppose. When you were doing your, or trialing your own corned beef, what was your corning process?
We just used salt, vinegar, onions, carrots, peppercorns, bay leaves, juniper berries, and just left it for a couple of weeks.
So you marinated it rather than injected it?
Yes.
Okay. What about other things that are, like bacon, for instance, that is smoked and comes pre-packaged? Do they have a lot of chemicals in them?
Generally speaking, the cheaper the product, the more additives and water will be in it. The bacon that we sell is a dry cured one, which is basically just rubbed with salt and sugar, and then it's allowed to sit for a week just to sort of pickle itself, corn itself, and then it's smoked in Manuka.
Ah, that sounds fun.
So it's not injected and pumped full of water. That's why a lot of the cheap bacon that you see around, when you actually fry it, you end up with a sort of a milky white residue in your pan.
You do, and a milky white piece of bacon.
Yes.
Yes. That's all curled up and revolting. Yes. Yeah, that's one of the things I've noticed with good quality bacon. It just sits in the pan and you don't even need to put much oil with it. You know, just lightly grease the bottom of the pan and it does its thing. It's wonderful. There's no residue. The same with sausages. With a good quality sausage, you don't get all the fat and stuff and water that comes out of them. I used to pre-parboil sausages before I did anything with them to get rid of all that stuff. But good quality ones, you don't need to do that.
Yeah. Well, we have a certain amount of fat in our sausages, but we don't put any chemical binders in there to hold the fat in. A lot of the sort of mass-produced, pre-cooked sausages that you get, they're not high meat content. There's a lot of cereal binder and other things in there, and they tend to be pork flavoured or beef flavoured.
That's one thing that worries me. And I pick up these pack in the supermarket, for instance, and I've got pork sausages, and then I read it closely, and it says pork flavoured sausages. So I think, what on earth is in it? Why do they have to add the flavouring? Is there no pork in it? Is it all just filling?
If you read closely, you'll find that the major contents will probably start off with water and then mutton.
Okay, mutton and pork sausage.
Yep,
why not? We're
talking to somebody who sells a lot of sausages, and I was asking about the difference between, you know, the pork flavoured and the beef flavoured. What is that? And basically, if you were making a proper sausage, it's the seasoning mix that you would use for a pork sausage that makes it pork-flavoured, or beef seasoning, which makes it a beef-flavoured sausage. So I don't bother with that. We make beef sausages out of beef and pork sausages out of pork. so we don't need to say the beef flavoured because they are beef sausages.
Yeah. You're on Waiheke Radio and we're talking to Steve Hill, our friendly village butcher up in Onuroa, and we're talking sausages at the moment. One thing I wonder about, is it possible today to buy a sausage that's in a natural casing rather than a plastic or produced?
Well, all our sausages are in natural casings. We use hog skins, and for the thin, the chipolata ones, we use their lamb skins.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, I was wondering whether that had gone by the board, where you could only buy the plastic ones. But fortunately, that's not the case.
Yes, no, we don't bother. I've tried using those. I mean, I find they're horrible anyway. But a lot of people use them for convenience. They're actually quite expensive. Well, having said that, the natural skins are probably the dearest part of the sausage. The skins are something like $40-something dollars a kilo.
Ah.
So they are quite expensive. And they are getting harder to find because we're not growing as many sort of pigs and sheep these days. A lot of them are imported from Australia, Canada or America.
Gosh, and they're not as good quality as our local animals were.
Well, they're reasonably good quality, but majority of them have to travel quite a way, and they're handled by several people before they sort of get to us. That's probably where the cost component really comes in.
Do we know what they're fed on?
No.
So they could, we really don't know what conditions they've grown up in. At least here we know that they were eating good grass or good fodder for the pigs. But they could have been like a battery farm situation.
It could well be, yes.
Mm. Yeah, so there's no regulation that says that when somebody imports an animal for consumption here, they've got to say what they were fed on and that sort of thing.
Not as far as I know. A lot of producers import meat, which is generally frozen and then processed, which then has to be cooked. Yeah, they can't sell it raw. There's a lot of... I'm just thinking the other day I heard something about Tesco's are wanting dog-free sheep. No, because the dogs are stressing the sheep.
Exactly.
Well, I don't know. It's taking things a little too far.
Mm. Yes, it's crazy, isn't it? Just one thing I was going to ask you. A friend asked me during the week if there's anything that I don't eat, don't like. And when I think about it, very little. But one thing that immediately makes me cringe, I've never, ever plucked up the courage to try it, and it's probably because of the way it looks or the way it's been cooked, and that is tripe. Now, people who eat tripe just love it, and it's wonderful with onions and white sauce and all of that sort of stuff. Is it in the way you do it?
It is. The tripe itself is... pretty bland. It's what's with it that really gives the flavour. I'm not a big fan of tripe. I used to have honeycomb tripe for lunch with salad, and I usually found the best part of that was the vinegar and the brown bread and butter that we had with it. That was the most exciting part of it.
What animal does tripe come from?
It's a cow.
It's a cow. Why don't we have tripe from sheep?
I dare say there are people or countries that do eat that. I suppose haggis is a sheep's stomach, so in a roundabout way, that is tripe.
Haggis is wonderful.
Mm. And a lot of Asian countries eat tripes, pig tripe. I would imagine Middle East, around there, they would eat a lot of sheep or possibly goat tripes of some description, whether that's some used as a casing.
Well, yeah. Well, from a load of tripe to wonderful ideas for winter stews and casseroles, thank you very much, Steve.
Okay.
It's been most enlightening. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday by Placemakers from 10 till 12. And also replayed on Tuesday nights at 7 o'clock. You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you by Placemakers every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with a replay of the interviews on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. All of these interviews are also available on our website, www.waihekiradio.org.nz. Mm-hmm.